on Chart Talk. Delighted to have Barbara Erickson, President and CEO of the Trustees of Reservations in Massachusetts, joining us in studio today, along with her colleague and regional manager, Joanna Ballantyne. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you.
Wonderful to have you here. Barbara Erickson became President and CEO of the Trustees of Reservations in July 2012, an avid explorer, passionate conservationist, and accomplished nonprofit business leader. Barbara came to the Trustees at an exciting time as the 121-year-old statewide conservation organization worked to build upon its legacy and accomplishments to engage more people, supporters, and partners in its mission. Formerly a vice president at Save the Children, a leading international nonprofit, Erickson was responsible for leading the organization's fundraising and engagement functions, raising a record $200 million in philanthropic revenues in 2011. I got to talk to you, Barbara. Before that, she served as chief development officer at Boston-based Earthwatch Institute, the world's premier environmental volunteer organization. During her tenure there, she spearheaded the diversification of the organization's revenue and funding streams, resulting in a rapid growth, oversaw volunteer engagement and external affairs, and served as primary strategic advisor to the CEO. Erickson has also had senior development positions at large nonprofits like Boys and Girls Clubs and American Cancer Society, as well as the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, one of Harvard Medical School's premier teaching hospitals. After becoming a Boston resident in 2001, she fell in love with Massachusetts' rich diversity of recreational, agricultural, and cultural resources, many of which are trustee properties, and developed an even deeper passion for the need to protect iconic landscapes and landmarks. A believer in strong communities, Erickson has been an advisor to the Conference Board's Corporate Citizenship Council and the Brookings Institution Corporate Volunteerism Initiative. Well, welcome to you, Barbara Erickson, and welcome to Joanna Ballantyne, because we're now going to ask you the questions which I'm sure everybody on the outside wants to know. Why should we care about you or your organization?
First of all, I need to take you home with me to do that spiel to my family. The Trustees is one of the largest nonprofits in Massachusetts and one of the oldest, working to conserve and preserve iconic and special places, as you mentioned. With the state of the world, and specifically the way we now live today, being able to access scenic, natural, and historic places, I think, is critical, not only for us as adults, but the next generation.
So why don't you give us an idea of some of the properties and some of the venues that you oversee?
Sure. We now own 110 special places throughout the state, including 14 in the Berkshires. We have everything from waterfalls, gorges, mountains, to historic homes, famous gardens, and national historic landmarks and natural landmarks.
So name a few.
Monument Mountain, I think, is one of our most iconic.
For those of you who have never climbed Monument Mountain, you have to do it. I live stone's throw, a walk from there. And I have to tell you, on several occasions, we have gone up that mountain. You can go up the hard way or the easy way.
You always do the hard way, I hope.
Well, I actually took a wonderful picture of a mushroom that had grown out of the rocks. And it is my finest photograph. We've had it framed, and we have it on the wall. It's really quite beautiful. And you get up to the top, and you see these wonderful things. First of all, some very famous people have made that trip. You want to tell us who they were?
Sure. One of the most famous experiences at Monument Mountain is actually Melville and Hawthorne, who climbed Monument Mountain together and actually had to take refuge during a rainstorm. And it's said to be that this is where the inspiration for Moby Dick came from, that they actually talked about it that night. So literary roots.
That's right. And of course, you know, this has been a people's place to go. It's like sort of a Central Park. Mm-hmm. You come to the Berkshires, you climb Monument Mountain, but you also go to other places. Where else?
So we also have Nam Keg and Stockbridge
Place. Nam Keg, which is where I met you. Mm-hmm. I said, who is that very distinguished person over there? So tell us a little bit about Nam Keg and why those of us who are struggling to make a buck should care about giving money to a place that has, you know, this sort of rich background.
Sure. Nam Keg is actually one of the famous Berkshire cottages and a great memory of the Gilded Age. the time of Graceful Living, now famous, obviously, with the Downton Abbey craze.
On public television. Yeah.
But, you know, it's a great example of what the wealth of New York and Boston meant to the Stockbridge community. The fact that they employed 40 year-round staff, even though they only housed there during the summer as a getaway, was really important to the vitality of that community.
Now, when you say the word cottages,
yes,
many of us think of little bungalows on the beach somewhere. These cottages were magnificent.
Correct. Yeah. You're talking about a very beautiful mansion that had 10 garden rooms, could house two distinct families, a beautiful example of architecture of the time, designed by McKeed, McKim, and White, who obviously did the Boston Symphony House and other famous institutions. But what's really spectacular, if you go to Naumkeag, and for which it's most known today, is the remaining gardens. There you have an example of modern landscape architecture, the first of its time, first in the nation, and really was the departure from European gardens to modern deco gardens, which Naumkeag has through the Blue Steps, which is an iconic garden room.
So how much does it cost to preserve a place like that?
So we were quite lucky that the Choate family left us.
Who are the Choate family?
The Choate family. Joseph Choate was an ambassador to Europe and also an infamous New York lawyer who settled in Stockbridge and named it Naumkeag after the town of Salem, which was the Mohegan term for place of peace. So settled there. The Choates obviously loved to entertain. It was a haven for a lot of activity. Mabel Choate, Joseph Choate's daughter, inherited it and thus began her love for gardening.
Ah, so how does something get to be under your purview? Because obviously you've got to raise a lot of money and you've got to do this thing. I'm thinking of our wonderful friends at The Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts.
Yep.
Which I would certainly love to see become one of your projects. And I'm sure so would they, if you would pay for it. But how does somebody work their way into your good graces?
It's a great question. So the trustees was established in 1891, and real visionary at the time, Charles Eliot, believed that there were not enough places that one could access available to the public. So at the time, there were no parks commissions. You wouldn't have had national or state parks at that time. So the fact that he was able to band a group of trustees, hence the name, to protect places for public use was incredibly visionary at the time. It preceded the National Trust of England, which we all know is a major organization there, and was the first conservation organization in the United States.
Really?
What makes the trustees unique is this idea of public access. We care about conservation and preservation, but it's all for use of the public. So when we think about acquiring a reservation, it's not just receiving beautiful places. It's places that have high engagement potential or we think have regional or statewide significance. So, of course, Naumkeag was a great example. The Mount is another. But we were fortunate that Mabel Choate cared for that property and wanted to see it cared for in perpetuity by us.
Did she give you some money?
She did, although it's important for your listeners to know and is a problem that the Mount and historic house museums around the state of Massachusetts and nationwide suffer from is that now these structures start to age, and what you plan for an endowment 75 years ago or 100 years ago is often not what you need today.
Tell me about it. The Shartocks own a house that was built in 1912, and it's apparently made out of sponge.
Yes, so we do. Naumkeag is a great example that while we were provided with an endowment, we do subsidize it by about $200,000 annually. So after all of the tickets and event opportunities and sales at the gift shop and the endowment, we raise unrestricted funds totaling $200,000 just to make that property
now,
whole.
Now, in each of these properties, like Naumkeag or Monument Mountain, can people give money that is directed not generally to the entire organization, but to that one project?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is the challenge of having 110 properties and also the benefit that every community has a property that they might be passionate about. For example, the people of Stockbridge might care about Namkeg or Mission House. If you're in Ipswich, you might care about the Crane Estate or Appleton Farms.
Tell us about the other places in Stockbridge.
Sure. I do want to talk about Monument Mountain a bit more, though,
because
I think it's a great example of what an organization like ours is challenged with.
Now, we're not talking about the high school, Monument Mountain High School. We're talking about Monument Mountain itself, right across the street.
Correct, the actual mountain. Yeah. And there's two things that we're constantly thinking about. The first is, how do we make people appreciate these natural places? I think often people assume that they're under government care.
Sure.
And the reality is that under private ownership like ours, the funding need is there, and also the attention and the care and the involvement of the community is important. The second is that the work is never done. So we actually have two parcels we're trying to protect that are contiguous to Monument Mountain, that abut Monument Mountain, that we believe are critical to the protection of the entire mountain itself.
So in other words, you don't own those yet?
We don't own those yet.
You would like to own them.
And that's an assumption, I think, when people think about conservation organizations working today, is that they'll see a sign up, this area has been protected. But as a conservation organization, we and many other land trusts working in this region constantly need to be thinking about the critical lands surrounding that. If there was a major development that were to come in right next to Monument Mountain,
that would
really change the beauty of it. And so
indeed,
we have two we're working on today with the landowners of those parcels, and they have been very receptive to conserving those. So we're fortunate to have that interest.
Monument Mountain, of course, it's a mountain, it's a hill, as opposed to a place like Namkeg.
Well, I think of
Mission
it as a
House.
Place, correct.
Okay.
It depends on how you think of place, right? So you have structure, four walls might be a special place.
Sure.
I think for mountains and scenic vistas, that is a special place for a specific individual who might have memories picnicking there or taking
long
hikes or being married there.
Yeah, yeah.
We actually have more than Monument Mountain. We also have Mount Warner and Mount Tom, so we own quite a few. Some of our other famous spots are Chesterfield Gorge. We own 70 miles of coastline in the state, so one of the most iconic.
And are people allowed to go to the beach there?
Yes, public access always.
You know, I love what you're saying. I got to tell you this, Barbara Erickson, and I'll tell you why. Because there are some land conservancies, and I love them. I think they're great. They're preserving a lot. But, you know, when you conserve a lake in the Adirondacks and then tell people that they can't swim in it or canoe in it, it seems to me that this is a hard sell for most, except a few people who may have a different view of life. So I love the fact that, you know, you are use-oriented in the properties that you guys protect.
And it is a delicate balance. I do think that that's where our organization has a powerful niche, is this idea of public enjoyment. I recognize that some landowners or some communities might not appreciate the idea of lots of the public coming in, but we as a conservation organization have always felt that the real value is this accessibility by all people. That being said, we partner with a lot of conservation organizations to achieve those reservations. So we might be fortunate to have a Mabel Choate who makes a gift of Namkeg, but oftentimes we will partner with lots of land trusts to make an acquisition.
Okay, so I want to ask you something. You are obviously, you know, in this business, you said the trustees of reservation. I'm fascinated about who these trustees are. Who are these people?
They are all of us. And so it's a curious name, I'm sure.
I think of, you know, a long table with halfway with ladies with garden hats on one side and guys with cigars on the other side.
Yes. What you should be thinking of is the 10,000 families at our family farm day in the fall.
Or so are those the trustees?
People out working in the gardens. Yes. Trustees are what we mean as our members and our public.
But am I unique in my
family? No, you are unique, but not in that regard. The trustees, it's a curious name, and I think once you understand what it means, it's inspiring. Before you do, it can sound a little bit bureaucratic, maybe.
But no, it sounds like people. It sounds like the trustees of Harvard or a dozen people. And so when you say the trustees of reservations, you think that you've got a bunch of trustees sitting around.
So at the time when we were created in 1891, the idea of park didn't exist. So a park was not a term in which we know it today. We called them reservations because that's what it would have implied in its day.
Oh, interesting. But when did Central Park come along?
Central Park was in the 1880s, I believe.
Interesting, yeah.
So,
okay.
But in terms of use for public, park wouldn't have been that ideal then. Uh-huh. And trustees, of course, meant what was the modern day use of volunteers. So we as trustees come together and we hold responsibility.
Believe me, I get it.
It's
but
hard.
I think there are other people like me who probably have this misunderstanding.
We often, the state of Massachusetts actually has reservations that are owned by the Department of Conservation and Recreation. So people will often assume that we are one and the same, which is a challenge.
And what's that called again?
The Department of Conservation and Recreation, DCR, owns state-owned conservation land, a powerful partner of ours, but their public spaces are also called reservations.
So how are they partners?
So we often work with them in terms of the agricultural preservation program. So we will work with them to protect farms around the state, of which we've done 26. We also work with them in terms of grant monies for various projects. So they just provided us $500,000 for a 6-acre community park in New Bedford, Massachusetts. So we work with them quite well, and this administration has been very supportive to conservation.
I wanted to talk to you about that very thing.
Yes.
I happen to be a great admirer of our governor, Deval Patrick. Yep. I love the guy. And here he is in the Berkshires. Does that mean anything for us and you?
I think he has been incredibly attentive to the entire state. So we have found him to be a wonderful partner of all of the gateway cities. He's also
What's a gateway city?
Gateway City is a metropolitan area, over 50,000 people, I believe. And so those include Springfield, New Bedford, Lowell, Fitchburg, and they have provided conservation support. And
I still don't get the gateway part of this.
Areas of economic growth opportunity. So gateway city meaning opportunity.
Meaning that they have problems and that you're going to help them not have problems.
Or you're right. Opportunities.
Or you're going to lose some relief to those cities which need a little relief.
Correct. And New Bedford is a great example of the way the trustees are working today. So currently we are...
It's way out on the coast, right?
Right. Way out on the coast.
An
important commuter.
Population.
Big Portuguese population. I'm told that 40% of the high school youth there do not graduate. So an opportunity for educational development, certainly. Our opportunity there is to provide a 6-acre green space in an area of New Bedford that doesn't have any green space within walking distance, and to provide a horticultural learning and professional development program.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
how do you know, Barbara Erickson, how do you know that these places won't be abused in some of these gateway places? I mean, you know, you have gangs in some of these cities and stuff.
So,
how do you know that they're not going to rumble?
Sure. We are very active. No, we are very active in involving the community. And we find that the local people that surround a reservation are often our best ambassadors and caretakers, similar to perhaps you with Monument Mountain. Whenever people visit regularly a reservation, they become our eyes and ears and care for the property. We also take great attention to involving the community. So while we seek to protect what is called the Haskell Community Park in New Bedford, we will involve lots of nonprofit partners, state, city, schools, and neighbors in the visioning for that
property. You keep talking about partnerships, but is there ever any territorial sort of competitiveness for who runs
that? And I think it's because our places are platforms. So if you think of a Boys and Girls Club or YMCA or the Food Project or Project Bread or any of the thousands of partners we have, we all understand the attachment to a place and the power of a place. And so for us, it's a great opportunity to expose many different audiences to a reservation. And we find that many of our partner organizations have great ideas on how to do that.
Yeah, but in the end, I'm a political scientist. It's all about power. Yeah. You know, who tells anybody else what to do? Okay, so I want to ask you this. When I had that misapprehension about who was a trustee, Who does run this organization? Is there a board of directors?
There is a board of directors, but we also have something called corporate trustees, of which there are 600 people.
These are people who just kick in.
They vote the president and the board slate every year. So it operates like a shareholder corporation,
really?
Which is, I think, a leftover, of course, from the era in which we were founded. So instead of having a traditional nonprofit structure, we actually have a group of 600 people from throughout the state. They are voted in mostly on geography.
How much does it count that they gave you some money?
They don't. That does not count.
So they're corporate.
Yes, it's an opportunity to have representation from the places where we have reservations and where we work. And we expect those people to come together for an annual meeting. And they vote me in and our board chairman and help support the strategy and the vision of the organization. It's a big task taking care of 600 voices, but I think, again, embodies the mission and the name.
Anybody ever call you up and say, I've got a daughter, you got a job for her?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I get lots of calls about do this with this trail and I'd like to see this roof. But that's the benefit of serving the community is that those voices, I do think, make us incredibly unique and make my job at times frustrating, but mostly fulfilling because you feel this real identity with these places that I feel like the spokesperson and the opportunity to help shape where we're going, but really deliver those voices into a coherent plan.
Well, Barbara Erickson, you've got to deal with a lot of wealthy people.
Yes.
I find that sometimes wealth breeds a certain kind of, arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a very well-known place in the Berkshires. I guess I shouldn't say it. And there was a guy there who ran, let's just say, food emporiums. And he looked around and he said, Doctor, I want to tell you, we gave this room.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said to me, let me show you the plaque.
Mm-hmm.
So he took me over to the side and he showed me this little plaque and he said, this is way too small.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, quote, get me that girl. And the girl, of course, was the executive director of a very famous woman, of the museum, which really ticked me off beyond belief. Now, you have to know how to deal with that kind of thing every day, don't you?
I think you become very attuned to psychology of people working in nonprofits because you are in the business of people. But I have to say that working with the trustees, there isn't this sense of empowerment or entitlement, and I mean that genuinely. If you notice, our reservations aren't named after the donors.
Yeah, yeah.
They're named after the places and the history. And perhaps some of that humility comes from the fact that these are people who bought these places, lived on these places, and so they love them like children, and their attachment is so strong that the mere act of giving it to the trustees and wanting to be accessible to the people, I think that's humility and real philanthropy at its core. I certainly, from my background, I've been in fundraising for a long time. And I have seen what is the society fundraising. I want the plaque. I want the distinguishment. I think with the trustees, it's more spiritual that you care for a place so much that I'll hear landowners tell me or people in a community raising money to save something that they want to see it like this for the next generation.
Not to be more than provocative than usual, but isn't there a sort of classism that comes out of this? I mean, sounds to me like this is the old money. This is the real old money that, says we don't need name. Mm-hmm. We don't even want to be recognized. We want to be anonymous or whatever else. Mm-hmm. So we do that as opposed to the nouveau riche. Just to be.
I don't think it's provocative. I do think there's an interesting study when you look at the trustees that we have been around for almost 125 years. We are one of Boston's first nonprofits, and Boston is a real hub of old philanthropy. But what I think is interesting about working in the state, and if you look across our history, these people took it very seriously and I think really have created a cultural philanthropy that we all benefit from today. So it's not about anonymous versus nouveau riche and more about the duty of having resources. And I think that's what makes, some of that old money characteristics unique. I will say it's not always about landowners, however. So, for example, one of our most iconic places is Waysquee on Martha's Vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
That was done in 1966.
When you say iconic, what do you mean by that?
A phenomenal beach, wildlife refuge, 400 acres, absolutely what Chappaquiddick and Martha's Vineyard would have looked like before it was developed, and a real sense of what being on Chappaquiddick is all about.
Yeah, but this is not an urban setting, a gateway setting.
No, but what is
interesting
about...
A bunch of very wealthy people who want to preserve what they got.
Well, except for the fact that it took 400 people to raise it over 3 years. And so it wasn't...
How much?
I forget the amount. I can get you that. But, you know, this was not obviously an easy feat. And maybe it was just the people of Chappaquiddick, but the fact that they cared so much to see it protected, and it wasn't about preserving their views, because essentially what they did is raise money to buy what was going to be Chappaquiddick by the Sea, which was going to be a multi-acre lot development, and then open it to the public. So you or me or the thousands of visitors that come from internationally across the state and regionally can benefit.
Barbara Erickson, what else do you have in Western Massachusetts that we should know about?
Sure. We have an iconic Nordic ski destination called Notch View in Windsor. This is our biggest reservation at 3,000 acres.
Wow, that's big.
I just visited there the first time during one of our great snowstorms. And it was
ski?
And it was like being in Scandinavia. It was that pristine, that beautiful.
Well, you look sort of Scandinavian.
Yes.
I take it you ski.
And good Norwegian roots. Yeah. But it was, I've been in Massachusetts since 2001, and I hadn't realized that we had such a resource. So I hope that our audience in the West and also the region gets out there.
I would hope so, because I'm not a skier, and I will never ski, because I believe in reading.
You can snowshoe.
Or watching television. But the interesting thing is, I've lived in the Berkshires since 1969, and I have never heard of this before. So your being here today is a great gift to all of us.
This is where our organization has to do better about marketing what these places are, because I have to say I've been at the Trustees for 9 months. Getting to Windsor was just awe-inspiring, and obviously we have lots of visitors. I think 20,000.
You have to groom the trails and do all of that.
Yes. And there's an active gatehouse. And of course, the day I was there, there was a teacher from Amherst who had brought his students there to see and cross-country ski.
Well,
phenomenal field trip.
Yeah.
But I really encourage people to get out and see it. And I look forward to going back next season.
You have your associate with you, Joanna Ballantyne of the famous beer company. And did she know? Well, you're married into it.
I did marry into the Ballantyne clan. Very affordable to ski at Notch View. And again, it goes back to our goal to be accessible to all in Massachusetts. A day ski ticket is $12 to ski at Notch View, or snowshoe. I took my almost 70-year-old mother on a snowshoe trek, Ellen, and it's fantastic exercise and fantastic to breathe the fresh air right here in the Berkshires.
Yeah.
You know, I think other properties, again, Western Massachusetts is unique in that we have historic homes with Ashley.
What's she got?
We've got Ashley House in Sheffield, Massachusetts, which
is Meryl Streep's favorite place, I'm told.
A famous slave rebellion. Mm-hmm. She really helped to lead the end of slavery in Massachusetts.
Who's
Mom Bett
is right,
her
Mom
name.
Bet.
And the Bryant Homestead, I want to mention also, which is in the Berkshires, which again is a National Historic Landmark, a spectacular place to visit, to learn about William Cullen Bryant and American history, really connected to even Lincoln.
Sure.
So beyond his poetry, I think Bryant is someone we should all know how he was connected to Central Park, to parks, to recreation.
To Bryant Park.
And how does this all... And wasn't there another property that the folks at the Red Lion helped to deal with?
Ash and Tully.
Right.
Yes,
the
Ash and
Gardens
Tully.
Of Ash and Tully, which John McLennan, the famous composer, not only composed music, but composed gardens. Mm-hmm. And his studio's open to the public. The gardens are accessible. The ruins of the homestead look like you're in Athens. They're spectacular. And that's hundreds of acres in Tyringham, Massachusetts, to hike and walk and sit by the waterfall.
I have to say, Ash and Tully is a spiritual place.
Is it? Why is that?
If you go to the Stockbridge or anywhere in the Berkshires, clearly there's an abundance of historic house tours. And we are fortunate to partner with Chesterwood and the Mount and others. And pleased that Nam Keg is included in that group.
Now, you mentioned Chesterwood. I'm so sorry. But isn't there something around Chesterwood also?
So Chesterwood is not one of our properties. It's owned by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. But we partner with them. And again, I think it's important that those institutions really help each other out and can market together wherever possible. Ashton Tully is a different story. It was one of the mansions of that era. It burned in the 50s. It was actually, they were burning trash and the mansion went down with it. The columns of that mansion are still standing, however, and it has an unobstructed view of Monument Mountain. So you hike up to where the original house was located, and you see these four columns just, and that's the only thing with the Monument Mountain behind you, McLennan Reservation, also ours in the backdrop. And it is the sense of something really sad and disappointing, but that the presence of the place is still there, yet the structure is not. So you can stand there at the ruins, and we've often talked about, do you have guided tours and signage, or do you just let the place be that? And that is what you experience when you go to Ashton Tully, and it's magical. And it doesn't need a guidebook. It doesn't need telling you what the mansion looked like or what to experience. You hike up the hill past John McLennan's gardens, and you just feel what that must have meant to that family and the community when that house burned down.
And what about famous people? I mean,
yes.
You know, famous people are interesting to me. You know, Abraham Lincoln is quite well known to all of us. And how much do those count in when you assess, one of your projects?
Sure. We have a major literary thread through some of our reservations. We own the Old Manse in Concord, one of our most visited properties because it's right next to the North Bridge. It is the house of Ralph Waldo Emerson, also visited by Nathaniel Hawthorne, where he etched nature into the window.
Well, those guys got around, though. They were Berkshires. They were over there.
Yes.
Yes,
but it was a site of major thought into transcendentalism. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot of
artists. What's transcendentalism?
Artists.
My wife has actually done research on this, so I've been inculcated with all of this.
You could speak better to it than I can.
Tell me.
But you do see the immersion of thought and independence, and what obviously Concord is a haven of patriotic thought at the time. Mm-hmm. But you certainly have this movement taking place at that time, and this traffic in this house, and the history and the literature that was inspired by it.
So when you go into these places, do you sort of try to concentrate in such a way as that you're now thinking about what it was when people other than us, you know, lived in that place? Do you try to project yourself into that?
Sure. This is something that preservation organizations are struggling with today. And I think it's a bit more difficult than a natural space, which, of course, you let people have recreation and nature is what it is to them. Trying to interpret or educate about the importance of a house in our modern day society is a bit more tricky, specifically with our youth and actually all of us with such a soundbite culture today and spending so much time in front of television and on screen. The idea that one would want to sit through a 2-hour house tour and be told what to appreciate.
Like somebody maybe in uniform.
Correct. And a PhD. So something that we've spent a lot of time thinking about at the trustee, and you'll see more from us as we move forward, the idea that we want it to be fun and stimulating and have it mean different things. For example, the Bryant Homestead in Cummington, which Joanna had mentioned, we recently hosted a school group from Groton and asked them to tell us what it was like to go into this house. And of course, a bunch bunch of 16-year-olds didn't say, oh, it's a wonderful haven of history and literature. What they said is, oh, it's kind of dark and depressing. And so we need to be talking to that generation in a way that makes sense. So some of the ways you can do that are having upstairs, downstairs tours. Where did the servants live? What was it like to be here? Staging the houses as an event that just took place. So instead of having everything behind velvet rope, which if you recall when we met at Namkeg was a bit like it felt there, right? Everything's tied down and behind rope and you walk through the rooms.
Don't touch.
So where can you bring in replicas? What is not so museum worthy or object focused that you can actually have people see what the bedspread looked like, go out onto the sun porch, actually touch one of the porcelain objects.
So how much do you have to, I mean, I was thinking when, as you were speaking about this, about the Tower of London and the guys in the beefeater uniforms. And
yes.
Great fun. And they spoke back to you. So it wasn't really necessary to have a tour as much as, you know, to just sort of see them in place. Because in terms of the costumes of the day, I mean, you would have been stoned if you dressed then as you're dressing now, right?
So, Alan, it's a good question because having not been from Massachusetts, I think perhaps being enamored with the history and the unique diversity of the places is easier for me. You don't come here and you suddenly there are mountains and coastline and all sorts of different historic structures and beautiful towns that have been lovingly preserved. Why is it that we travel to Europe to learn all about another country's history, and yet we don't have that interest to do it here? And I think maybe it's a bit of the American thought, right, that we all are about looking forward. So how do we infuse that history in education while keeping it fun and adventurous? And so one of the ways we've done that at the Crane Estate in Ipswich, Massachusetts, up in the North Shore corner, instead of having a traditional house tour, we actually have something called Summer Quest, where the children arrive for summer camp, although we would never call it camp to them. And they actually go on what is kind of like a pirate's journey. So they go through the salt marshes and they try. It's like a scavenger hunt that goes over several weeks. And everything has an educational component so that they have to learn about the ecosystem of the salt marsh to be able to advance to the next section. Then they learn about coastal erosion. And I think that there you are providing a wonderful education that's very rich and cohesive, but you're doing it in a way that they have no idea that they're even learning. They think they're on a big adventure. So
that's the
challenge always.
So now we, of course, in Western Massachusetts, I live in Great Barrington, we have a huge supply of great cultural institutions. Mm-hmm. We've got Jacob's Pillow, we've got, you know, Tanglewood, we've got
all it's a cultural places. Hotbed so, of the state.
So how do you work with existing resources in terms of what you do?
Sure. So recognizing that this is an area of the state that has a lot of nonprofits in it and worthy nonprofits, we seek to partner where we can. For example, we are celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Blue Steps at Namkeg on July 20.
Of the what?
At the Blue Steps, one of the most famous garden rooms at Namkeg. And we're looking to have Tanglewood or Jacob's Pillow come in and be part of that experience. I think the worst thing that
when
could happen...
When you say looking to, what do you mean?
Yes, we're actually in active conversation with
get
both.
Get Yo-Yo to come in and play a cello?
Not even so much Yo-Yo, although we like him very much. It's this idea of the up-and-comers at Tanglewood. So do you get Tanglewood?
Young
students.
People who are there in the camp.
Right.
You know,
I think that for the Berkshires, TMC. Although it plays out across the state, the worst thing we can do is be trying to have this care about me only.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
No, the worst thing I think that any nonprofit today, specifically in the Berkshires, is to say, oh, we are the most important and only support us. I think it's far more interesting for the experience and also for the audiences we're talking to highlight what are the unique niches of all of our work. So instead of competing with a Jacob's Pillow or competing with the Mount or Tanglewood, to actually figure out ways that we can play off each other and to make an experience that's even more rewarding. A good example of that actually was the historic holiday celebration they did in Stockbridge on December 1, where each of us had our houses open to the public, but we coordinated so each was open at a different period of time to really, and so instead of trying to get everybody to your house and hoping they don't go to others, actually taking the reverse approach and saying, okay, the mount's at 1 o'clock, Nam Keg's at 2, et cetera, et cetera.
We are talking to Barbara Erickson, president and CEO of the Trustees of Reservations, and with her is our colleague and regional manager, Joanna Ballantyne. So our listeners always want to know a little bit about who they're hearing from. Mm-hmm. So where were you born and where were you raised, Barbara Erickson, and educated?
Yes, I was born in Kansas, of all places.
Really? Did you know Dorothy?
Yeah. One of the few people that might be in this area of the world after having been born there. I grew up in Wyoming. And I think that that was more catalytic than I appreciated at the time, because when you come from Wyoming, you are in the land of open space. I don't think I even knew what the term conservation was, because, of course, it didn't really seem as an issue.
Well, an issue
when I was growing up is that I remember when I first started to learn how to drive, my father would pack my trunk with socks and water and blankets and food, because if you actually took out on the open road, you might not see anybody for a day. And so I grew up in this wonderful, pristine nature, and my childhood memories are mostly filled with exploring the outdoors. I go back to that Wyoming of today, where my sister still lives, and it is full of suburban sprawl. Obviously, the coal and natural gas developments have really changed the Wyoming of my youth. And I am so incredibly fortunate to be now living in a state where conservation was in the mindset 125 years ago.
Conservation was invented.
Right, where conservation was invented. So I grew up there. Came to Massachusetts.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to college in Arizona. Again, good old Western gal.
What place?
Kansas. I went to Northern Arizona University.
Really?
Which was up in the middle of nature as well, Flagstaff. And, you know, very classic youth, right? So grew up in Wyoming. You go off to Arizona for school. I thought I was going to be a journalist and decided that I really liked mission-oriented work, and really thought that getting people mobilized around an issue they cared about was very inspiring to me. Went to work for the American Cancer Society.
Wait, what'd you major in?
English.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It should have been a political science.
But I fell into the American Cancer Society, which seems like a long time ago, but I have to say one of the best nonprofits in the United States in terms of how they treat people and change ideas about nonprofit management and just the tools of working with volunteers. I mean, American Cancer Society really, lifeblood is volunteers. And so I think I had an opportunity to see nonprofit management at its best, and moved to Massachusetts in 2001 to work for one of the Harvard hospitals. I'd only ever been in Boston for one day when I moved, so it was a big chance. Fell in love. My husband tells me that my soul was born in Massachusetts.
Is he from Massachusetts?
He's not. He's from Guatemala, but he gets to see all of the amazing sights of Massachusetts through my work with the trustees.
Right.
So it's a real family affair.
Well, you know, you've had several jobs.
Yes.
We have a term in academia called the trailing spouse.
and that he has. A few states.
Is he the trailing spouse?
Yes, he's the trailing spouse. I took him down to Westport, Connecticut to work for Save the Children. We got to explore all of New York and Connecticut, which was quite enjoyable, but I missed Massachusetts greatly, so we came back.
How did you happen to marry a Guatemalan?
I worked for an international environmental organization called Earthwatch, which uses scientific research, and volunteers are recruited globally to participate in that research. And we met on a coffee project, working on sustainable coffee production in, of all places, Costa Rica.
What's sustainable?
Convinced him to move up north. Sustainable is the idea of reduced use of pesticides, smaller carbon footprint. How do you actually limit the supply chain, transport? And so, of course, working in a coffee cooperative in Costa Rica, where 2,000 coffee farmers are eager to understand how they can make an improved margin and also do things more sustainably. I think everybody at their core is open to idea of sustainable interventions if they're just given a way and a model that doesn't hurt their pocketbook. And so Earthwatch is a phenomenal organization. So, you know, the thread, which is somewhat obvious, is this idea of volunteers and interacting with communities has been throughout my career and certainly has an important part of the trustees.
Do you have children?
I do, two young ones. Mm-hmm. And I think a great example of the trustees being about all different kinds of audiences. Here they hire a woman from Wyoming with two young kids, and it really represents the face of the trustees today, that it is about getting the young involved, that it is about speaking to all different kinds of audiences and being available for use and enjoyment.
We professors try to inculcate our students with concepts, and I mean concepts. We try to tell them, you know, things that will, as opposed to facts, that will be important for them figuring out things later in life. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, when you go back to Arizona and think about what you learned in college, mm-hmm. is there anything that sometimes, in my case, you know, I studied French and Spanish along with political science, and I had to memorize all those idioms.
Yes.
And I never did anything with them, but now today I'm sleeping and they come back popping into my head.
I think
femme de loup and things like that.
I think what being an English major, and I'm always a fan of English majors, so I'm somewhat biased in that regard.
You know, Garrison Keillor is too, the society.
Yes, well, the power of the word.
Yeah.
And one of the learnings from my education is that a story is such a powerful way to teach people. And I've tried to bring that to the trustees. Instead of hearing about, you know, Monument Mountain or Appleton Farms and me telling you all the statistics that make it great, I think the story is so much more inviting, and it's something people relate to.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by
this. So, it was a great example, actually. It saved the children. You could talk all day about the millions of children suffering from poverty or death, and the eyes glaze over, right? But if I tell you about a story of, you know, 3-year-old Josie, you'll listen because it's the way we humans relate. And I think that being an English major and the use of that word and how to draw somebody in is important in business, is important in nonprofit, it's important in life. And when you're talking about place, conservation can sound very academic and intellectual and ivory tower. We save places for the benefit of nature, for the benefit of perpetuity. And if I'm 9 years old, I'm bored. But if I can tell you about a place and a cool story that happened there, you'll listen because that's how we how we learn, that's how we experience. And so
some transcendentalist climbing a mountain, that becomes an important story.
Well, I think if you know that Moby Dick was conceived at Monument Mountain, and it's more than just a wonderful hike.
I thought he was conceived by his parents in the ocean.
So I find that it's the power of communication to relate to people, to relate to the staff, the volunteers, communities where we hope to work and where we see that there's need. I think that being an English major and appreciating the power of conversation and writing.
What about politicians? Obviously, you have to deal with politicians.
Yes.
We
like to deal with politicians.
Why? What is it about?
Because they are representatives of their constituencies.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that, yes, it is a part of being in the business of on-the-ground organization, that you work with politicians all the way from local up to federal. But I think
Is it hard?
Of course it's hard. It's hard because you're on a constant discussion, right? So it's, you know, you have the same discussion, and in 2 years it's the same discussion with a new person, and constantly needing to beat that drum and think of new ways to beat that drum.
It's like teaching, because you never remember whether you told this class or the last class something you're about to tell them.
Well, and conservation's hard because there's so many benefits to economy and quality of life in communities. But I think that environmental issues overall can sometimes be thought of as a topic that's not of interest by the mass public. But if you talk about bringing jobs to a community, about the importance of trees or green space in a community and what that can do for the quality of life, I do think that politicians will respond. But there's a learning over and over and over again, and making sure that your voice is creative enough that it gets through the noise and actually resonates. And I think the trustees and others have done very well. We've been fortunate to have a phenomenal governor who's cared about these issues, and mayor in Boston, too, who's been wonderful to us. and many mayors around the state.
And we've all gotten to know them, unfortunately, through a bad circumstance.
Yes,
recently.
Yes.
Barbara Erickson, you're a woman. We have the only program, I believe, in public broadcasting about women, 51%. Mm-hmm. And we hear a lot about glass ceilings all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the glass ceiling for you?
I think that I've experienced it a few times. In fact, Joanne and I were talking on our drive to see you today, Alan, that there is a responsibility about being a working mother, that you have this guilt with the work-life balance, and that we need to be talking openly about that. And I think the nonprofit industry is more friendly, but that doesn't make it less difficult.
Well, how have you experienced it? You say you've
I certainly have worked for many established institutions, and I think that when you see your counterparts being able to pull long hours and be able to jump on a plane at a moment's notice, and you've got a nanny to worry about or a child pickup or a sick child, how do you manage that, but not in a way that makes you embarrassed about it? Because if we're embarrassed about it, I think we're just setting up other mothers and other working women for the same problems.
So when you deal with politicians who have a reputation sometimes of being sort of wolfish, not always, but I don't want to stereotype, and only for the purposes of identification here, you're a fairly attractive woman. How does that, is it help or hurt you?
This is good, it's radio. You know, I think I represent a powerful audience for politicians. I mean, working mothers with young kids are certainly very vocal
about when you walk in the room and all of a sudden they see this very attractive woman. Does that help you or hurt you?
You know, I think what helps me is that I'm passionate about the issues and that I actually have something to say. Does how I look or the fact that I'm female help? Maybe. But that's a good thing for conservation. And I think having more females in the field can only serve us well. We have a diversity issue in conservation, something the trustees have been working on
for
10 years. That if you look at conservation and environmental employment in the for-profit or nonprofit sectors, still predominantly white male. And so you have to go that extra step. I think the trustees hiring a female was a great message.
And do you remember your interview at all?
Yes, of course. It was six months long.
What was that? It was how long? 6 months?
6 months.
They kept calling you back.
It was an intense search process run by the board of directors who was quite rigorous. And so, yes, we got to know each other very well.
Did anybody ask you a question you didn't like?
No, I think that it was, you know, helpful to learning about a fit because I'm leading an organization that serves 75 different communities in Massachusetts. And you want to know that you're in it for the long haul and that you can stand the test of hard issues and that you're passionate about the work so that it gets you up every day. So I think the hard questions were the right questions.
So 6 months and then finally you get the word.
Yes.
Do you remember the day you got the word?
Yes, and I'll tell you where I was. I was at Bart's Cobble in Sheffield, Massachusetts, taking a hike with my kids and going frog hunting. A really wonderful day.
Were you already living there? No.
I was up. We were at the time in Connecticut, and Sheffield is an easy drive, obviously, from southern Connecticut. And the vernal pools were bubbling, and we were out frog hunting with the kids with one of the rangers. So that was just a wonderful family experience. And I got the call.
Did you bring home any frogs?
No, that would be bad. Okay. But it cemented the whole journey because what it did is, you know, you see your children picking up frogs and the natural instinctive attachment they have to explore the world and to get a call to see if I'd like to come lead the trustees. It was a match.
And how did you get it? How did you get the call? Was it on a cell phone?
Yeah, it was on a cell phone. But I have to say, coming to work every day is fun. So you feel almost like a benefit to be able to represent this organization and to be able to go see these amazing places and meet these amazing people. And so it's fun. It doesn't feel like going to an office and sitting there waiting for the clock to run out.
Is it your last stop, or would you like to be here forever, or would you want to go and do something better?
I will be involved with the trustees forever. I think that if I were CEO,
political answer.
No, I have a few thoughts on presidents of nonprofits or corporate. I think if you stay too long, you lose the opportunity for the fresh eyes and the creativity. Mm-hmm. And so my hope is a decade or so.
I've been here since 1979.
here's my plan. I think 10 years or so, maybe more, but while I'm here to cultivate my successors and my leadership so that they can take the organization forward. I think that new chapters are healthy. Everybody brings new ideas, and I think that having a stable leadership team and stable staff is great, but I also think that people who bring fresh perspectives is also helpful. So it's a nice mix.
Now, Barbara, so how have you done in breeding diversity within your organization?
So it's actually one of our values, and I have to say my predecessor, Andy Kendall, really kicked it off, and I think that it's hard, but we take it very seriously. It's not as simple. Because you can't just put out a job announcement and expect that you're going to get all kinds of people to respond. It's in your language. It's in the who are you marketing to? How are you visible? And I think that Holyoke is a great example where we have two properties there and we are very much embedded in the Hispanic population. It's a challenge city, but where you take the extra step is you hire staff that represent the population. Your materials are in Spanish and not just formal Spanish. Being married to a Guatemalan, I can appreciate having a Latin Spanish. And
have you learned Spanish?
I'm not good at speaking it, but yes, I understand it. My kids are fluent, so I'm incredibly fortunate. But you have to get into and live in the community. So we're actually right in downtown Holyoke. We have an office there that you can stop into right off the street. So if you were to walk in, we would talk to you about the properties in your area. So if we just expected that we could, you know, send out a job posting to Holyoke from headquarters and expect that we would get the representation of the population, that would be foolish. You have to go one step further. But I think that it's about achieving the mission and also getting new perspectives. And
now, there are members of the Supreme Court who don't believe in this. Mm-hmm. You know, they think that, you don't want to hire somebody because they're black or because they're Latino. But you're telling us the opposite, aren't you?
Well, as an organization that is for access by all people, we have to represent the population we serve. And I'm not saying that it's easy and it's a struggle and you do have to go that extra step and make that extra investment, but we find that it's the only way to get to the audiences that should be accessing these places. Everybody should be able to see our special places.
I also think, Alan, it's a long-term proposition that we have about 70 young people who are part of our Youth Conservation Corps throughout the state, including a crew of young people from Holyoke. It's an application process. It's rigorous. They become youth corps members. They walk the trails. They steward the properties. They engage. And so our hope is that by inspiring 16 and 17-year-olds in 10 years, when they're looking for employment, they will know that the trustees of reservations invested in them. They will hopefully join our professional team. So I think it's not just job postings, as Barbara said so eloquently. It's really engaging a whole new population so they'll be part of our mission from their own young core.
Well, Joanna, thank you for that. So, Barbara, if people want to get in touch and know more about all of this, how would they do it?
Our website is www.thetrustees.org. We're also active on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, etc. But the website has all of our reservations that are open to the public and a wealth of information about programs and activities.
And give us the website one more time.
Sure, thetrustees.org.
I want to just take a moment to tell everybody we've been talking with Barbara Erickson, President and CEO of the Trustees of Reservations, and her colleague and regional manager, Joanna Ballantyne. Barbara, Joanna, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. It was a real fast hour, and I really appreciate your coming all the way over here and talking to us.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.